Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. This is Latino Role Models and Success Program here. And I'm Armando Sanchez, executive producer and host. Thank you for being with us today. We're very honored and the pleasure of having Raul Ramos y Sanchez, who is an author. And he comes out with another book, Pancho Land. And we want to get the background, not only on his book, but we want to sort of get a feel for what develops in an individual to be an author. It's a very difficult and challenging field. You know, you're working, investing a great deal of time and energy, never quite knowing how your literary work will be received. So I applaud the work of Latino authors, and it's so critical that we continue to get a Latino perspective, not only from the United States, but from persons who have lived throughout Latin America, and be able to bring us in the insights so that we can all understand the need for diversity. So please participate, listen to the discussion we will give out during the program, contact information to continue highlighting this fantastic author and his book, all three of them, and more to come, I'm sure, in the future. With that, let's greet him. Raul, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Armando. Very, very glad to be here with you today.
Thank you very much. And let's begin to get a background. Raul is born, and Raul, somewhere along the line, says, I'm going to be an author. Sort of in a quick synopsis, could you sort of tell me how you grew up and how you came to decide to enter the field of being an author, and what motivated you to write these particular themes that are very very timely to the day?
Well, thank you, Armando. I think, you know, the Latino Role Models is really a good platform for me to explain how I decided. When I was growing up, I was born in Cuba, but came to the U.S. At the age of six, and that was actually before the revolution in Cuba. So we were a small group in Miami. Later, as more exiles came over, I had a chance to grow up near a family where one of the exiles was a writer. His name is Jorge Yanis, and Jorge wrote for the Cuban equivalent of Life magazine, which was called Bohemia. At that time, there really weren't any Spanish-language publications, even in Miami, believe it or not, but we're talking about the early 1960s. And so Jorge was hard-pressed to find any kind of employment at all, but he still could regale us with his stories and his storytelling ability. And I think that influence, that I knew someone who was a writer, was very instrumental in empowering me to think that someday, you know, that's something that I could do as well.
Well, now, a little bit of background on his writing. What kind of writing did he did in terms of, was it political? Was it just sort of general information?
He wrote both. The political stuff was that got him exiled. And so he was on a list of people that I think needed to get out of the country soon because he had not been completely favorable in his writing of Fidel. And so that's how he found himself in Miami. But later on, I did find that after I was also very fortunate, speaking of role models, I went to Miami Jackson Senior High School, another school which had just come out, well, Miami had just come out of the Jim Crow era. And they were beginning to integrate the high schools. And so I had a chance to meet all different kinds of people, and from all walks of life, of all races, and also some fantastic teachers. And again, these role models were people who told me, you can do whatever you want. You believe in yourself, and you can achieve. And it's so important for young people to have that. And it's so sad that today, you know, with Latino children being 25% of the public school enrollment, that they really do have so few role models that they can follow other than those pathetic stereotypes that are most often portrayed in the media. And I think that, you know, it behooves all of us who have, you know, to support your work and the work of organizations that are trying to create positive role models for Latino students, because we really are in need of them. And I want to applaud you and your work for what you do, because I think it's a very important and much needed role.
Very honored. Thank you very much. You know, given that you're a writer, share with us why are writers feared by governments around the world? What, you know, the media fear writers. Why is there so much fear toward writers?
Well, I think, you know, the old saying, the pen is mightier than the sword. Today you could probably say the keyboard is mightier than the sword, but I think when you look at the ability for writers and artists to crystallize the truth is a very, very powerful thing. You know, Pablo Picasso said, art is the lie that tells the truth. And by creating fiction, we actually can reach people in a way which plain news, even documentaries, do not. It puts the reader in the place of a real breathing human person when the writing is good. And it allows you to see the world through another person's perspective. That's a very, very powerful, powerful thing. And I think that's the reason why, you know, as you say, writers are feared, and certainly in many cases and in many, many political systems, you know, ostracized and, you know, banished and exiled and all the other things because of the fear of what's happening. And look, in Tucson last year, they banned Latino studies. I mean, how? What better example of fear can you show than that? That all the books, and I only wish that mine had been one of the banned books.
Rudy Acuña is not a happy camper. We've had him on the show several times. So he is, but he's taking it as a point of energy, not something that wear him down. He re-energized Rudy, even though he's up in his age. So have you experienced that through your lifetime as you're writing books? And this is being your book we want to talk about in a few moments. Have you experienced this, the negativity about your books or people trying to discourage you from writing and highlighting these issues of Latinos?
Well, not directly in telling me, but it is, there certainly is a systemic issue in public, in publishing, and also in the entire broadcast industry as well. I mean, if you look at just, you tell me if there's a barrier or not. But when you have 25% of the students in public school systems being Latinos, and according to a New York Times article that just came out yesterday, only 3% of the books used, children's books, have either a Latino character or written by a Latino author, you realize that there seems to be a systemic kind of resistance to works published by Latinos. Now, we all have our superstars, you know, and you can't deny that there are those Latino writers who have achieved great things, starting with Junot Diaz and you know, working your way throughout the whole panoply. But nonetheless, I think we still struggle, because I think that when people see a Latino name, they make assumptions, just like they do about any other kind of, and when I say prejudice, I mean prejudge. Not in the sense that there's a willful discrimination, but rather there are assumptions made. And I think the idea is, for example, that Latino-themed movies are not going to sell very well, despite the fact that Latinos are overrepresented among moviegoers. I think that you'll find Edward James Olmos and Latino Literacy Now has long, long campaigned for getting more Latino writers, more Latino characters, more Latino themes in Hollywood movies and TV shows than we currently have. So as a group, I think we're woefully underrepresented. And so I don't think that it's a prejudice in the sense of that it's a willful discrimination. I think it's a prejudice in the sense of prejudging what you believe as a producer or as a you know, as a funder of a film or the publisher of a book, will, that the audience will be for that work. And it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. If it doesn't get out there, it's never going to get read, or it's never going to get seen. So we're caught in that vicious cycle, and it's going to be double the work for all of us you know, to change that.
You know, I remember hearing from several authors I was sitting in on the discussion, and they were sharing that they were finding more readers in Europe for Latino literature in the United States than there was here in the country itself. And sort of as I've done little research in that area, I find that to be true. There's very high-ended interest worldwide. Even Israel has shown a great deal of interest on reading and understanding Latino writing and understanding the character of where the United States is going. And it seems that here in our own backyard, we're still sort of fumbling around like, where are the Latino writers? Do they have any books? You know, are there any literary works we should refer to? And I scratch my head and wonder, so what's going on here? But let me go on. Where did you turn the idea? You had the influence by Yanis to be a writer. You met somebody. But where did you decide, I'm going to start writing? How did that come about? And you said, you know, my ideas are important enough to put on paper, and I want to get it out there.
Sure. Well, for most of my career, for about 25 years, I worked in advertising. And that's a different kind of fiction, as I like to say.
Big one.
but after doing having a successful career and you know learning the craft of writing, I decided I'd reached a point where I had been successful enough that I could take a sabbatical and step back from the day to day and begin to do things that meant something to me. And so at that point, that's when I decided that I would, go into writing my own stories. And that was right after the turn of the century, in beginning around 2003 was when I started the first of the series. And actually, I had been working on trying to launch a PBS or a public television documentary, which was not successful. But a lot of the research with the professors that I had on board, which were just an incredible team, was just all this fantastic material. And the producer that I was working with on film said, you ought to write a book about this. And I thought, well, you know what? It's something that I can finish. As getting a film done is a project that what somebody once called film, the art form where the medium is money. And it just takes more money than almost any one of us can put together to do a film. A book, I thought, well, I've got a word processor, I can finish that. So I began to take some of the themes and some of the material from this documentary and weave it into a fictional story, which very quickly became nothing like the documentary, which was very intellectual. The book actually started with what turned out to be the very last scene of the trilogy, and I was writing, and I won't tell you what that is, because obviously then you'll know the whole trilogy. But interestingly enough, I began with a scene which was what turns out to be the last scene of the third book, and then I began working backwards from that point. And three books later, with the publication of Poncho Land, I finally reached that last scene. So it began in 2003. Here we are entering 2013. So that gives you an idea of how the publishing world moves. And I think the publishing world in a glacier in a race would be pretty much a dead heat. So after working in advertising for so many years, when you can do a whole, in 2 weeks you do a year's campaign, in the publishing world in 2 weeks your editor will call you back. So it's a different world for sure.
Let me ask one question. How does a person who wants to be a writer overcome their demons and their fears as they're going through the process? Will this be received? Will this be read? Will it be accepted, et cetera? How do writers deal with those demons?
Well, the blank page, I always say, is a perfect page. And then you start putting words on it, and then you realize, oh, that isn't any good. It could be better. And so I like most writers, you just have to start. You just have to just do it. And what you're going to find is you're going to be terribly disappointed with what you do. Every writer does that. In fact, I think it was Hemingway said that writers don't write, they rewrite. And so you begin to work, think of it as a carving a sculpture. You have this big block of marble, and you just keep chipping at it, and then you knock out the rough shape, and then you fine it down until finally you're down there with an emery board, and you're smoothing out the surfaces many, 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 many hours later. and then you have something that you feel you can show people. But the most amazing thing that I've learned is that everyone thinks it's who you know in the business, but I can tell you that if you work and you create a draft, a manuscript that is good, and you begin to show it to people and you're persistent with it, you can make progress and you can get published. But it's a very, very difficult and very it's a process ridden with a lot of rejection. You're going to get a lot more no's than you get yeses, and you got to develop a very thick skin and realize that just because somebody is turning you down doesn't mean your work isn't any good. It just means that it wasn't right for them or they didn't think it was well. So I think that the most common quality in all published writers is persistence, more than talent. It is persistence. So that's my advice, is write, and then, you know, keep persisting in trying to get it in front of the right people.
And then when you finally do finish it, no matter what, you're still going to get shot down even after the work is finished. And that's just part of the nature of people says, you know, why did you write that? Why did you say that? Oh, my God, what were you thinking when you said that? But yet, ultimately, that was the outcome of writing, to create that reaction. Am I off on this?
Very, very good point. No, I think that you have to expect that, you know, when you put work out there, and I had the good fortune of working for 25 years with advertising, where, you know, your work is very, very critically examined by your clients. And then it goes into the marketplace, and it becomes critically examined by even more demanding group, which is the people who are intended. And it's either going to work or not. So you have to develop a thick skin. And I fortunately came into the fiction business, if you will, with already a predisposition to be resilient. But one of the things that struck me about professional book reviewers that it struck me as one time someone said it was the a person who's never been published taking out their frustrations on somebody who has. And it can get pretty mean. But you gotta take that. That's part of it comes with the territory, you know. You have to accept the fact that that you're gonna get knocked. And if you can't take that, don't do it. But I encourage people who do have the desire to stand up to it, to get tough and to go ahead and move forward and do it, because it's part of the landscape.
You know, this brings me to an issue. You just reminded me, I had a conversation with an English teacher in the classroom in high schools, and I've made it a point to interview several of them just on my own. And it always fascinates me that all day long they're criticizing and critiquing the writing of students. And yet I've asked them, I said, why don't you write an article that we could use and highlight? And they said, oh, no. I'm not a writer. I'm just an English teacher. Oh. And I've had trouble, you know, wrapping my head around that one. So you're right. I think persons that do critique should have also the background to share their own work of what they've learned. Let's talk about your book. Your newest book came out, Poncho Land, and a very interesting profile is the idea of ethnic conflict, modern warfare, you know, using nuclear devices in the Midwest. I mean, you know, what were you thinking when you were writing this book?
Well, you know, the whole idea that I toyed with when beginning the whole series was that, having worked in advertising, I know that there's no message that's any good unless it reaches people. And so I felt like I had a unique perspective to offer. I've lived for the most part in the Midwest of the U.S., in a very diverse community, and with perspectives that I don't think that the average person might have. So I thought, you know, sharing that perspective might be something worthwhile. But, you know, just how do you get that out there? And I thought, well, a thriller is the kind of novel that's very popular because it's engaging, it's a page-turner, it's a kind of a story that draws people in. And they're often themed with, you know, things like Cold War enemies and terrorists and all that kind of stuff, which, of course, conflict is, you know, the heart of drama. I mean, if you don't have conflict, you know, you don't have any kind of story. It needs to have some form of you know, antagonism. But at the same time, I thought, well, maybe I could use this thriller genre to get across the idea of some of the dangers that our society faces from prejudice and ignorance towards Latinos. And so what I did was I constructed this nightmare scenario where we have the Latino community being incited into an uprising by escalating vigilante violence, demagogic politicians. You know, you've seen a lot of the things that have come as a consequence of the whole toxic debate on, towards the undocumented, and how that could escalate into, with these vigilantes on the border, the growth of groups like the Hutari militia, you know, all of these armed groups that are growing, and so could these things ever lead to this nightmare scenario where we would actually have a Latino liberation movement, an ethnic conflict similar to what we've had in places like the Balkans, the Basques in Spain, the Tamils in Sri Lanka, the Chechens in Russia, where you have conflict over soil. And let's face it, when you're in California, you know, you look at Los Angeles, San Francisco, San Luis Obispo, you know, this wasn't always a U.S. of A, you know? And so you have, in some ways, you have the foundations of an ethnic conflict like some of these that I just described. So I thought, well, if things got bad enough, you know, could it ever reach this point? And so I painted this cautionary tale, putting blood on the streets in the hope of it never happening in reality, to wake up people to the idea that, geez, we're really playing with a very volatile thing here when we start demonizing a whole entire ethnic group of people, when in fact they're the fastest growing ethnic group in the country, and they also have ancestral claims to the very land that they're on. Wow, that's not a great combination to demagogue, but that's exactly what a lot of politicians are doing. So that was the
So let me bring it to the present. So Latinos in the United States who work on farms, farm workers, decide, you know, they don't want to do that work anymore, enslave themselves to picking up our food, and they all walk away. Didn't they have a union issue in Manhattan the other day where all the workers from the major fast food locations just walked off mm-hmm. the job at the same time? But
wow.
If you start dealing with the issue of food, and South America, Latin America, that ships a lot of food up here, decides, you know what, we're going to double our price. We're going to be like the Arabs. We're just going to double the price, triple the price, and send it to the United States. But this starts as being one possible way of starting this ethnic issues and bringing some attention to the economic strength of the country.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that what the novels posit is the idea that there are extremist groups on all sides of this issue. You know, we do have Latino separatists who believe in very, very few, but they're there. They're as prevalent as maybe the Ku Klux Klan might be in the mainstream community. But what happens in this scenario in the novels is that the extremists wind up controlling the dialogue. And then the people in the middle are forced to choose sides. Am I on this side or am I on that side of the wall? And that's where it really turns ugly. And the protagonist in the story, his name is Manolo Suarez, and he's a third-generation Mexican-American, barely speaks any Spanish. He's a decorated veteran of the Afghan War. He has a family. He has a job. He wants nothing to do with this whole, you know, uprising that's taking place around him. But through circumstances beyond his control, he's drawn into this conflict. And so through Mano's eyes and through his family, we begin to see how the mainstream or the main Latino population could become radicalized by these kinds of events. And so that's part of the story. Poncho Land, by the way, the books, there's three books, they're meant to be read in any sequence. You could read Poncho Land first and go back to America Libre or House Divided, there's all three. But they're written in such a way that each one of them has their own unique identity as part of this bigger picture. And it spans all the books span a period of, well, actually, from beginning to end, it's a 40-year period of history. But most of the active scenes are in about a 15-year span.
We want to give our listeners a contact information where they can find your book, Raul, and get more information, websites, et cetera. Before we go there, let me ask you one last question at my end. Do you see at this moment bits and pieces of activity going across the United States that could bring what you wrote about to fruition, so going from a fiction to a nonfiction status?
I'm sorry, Armando, I didn't quite get the
That's
question.
Okay.
Would you mind?
I'm saying, do you see anything in real life, in the news, in television, in your own experiences, that could bring these stories that you bring through your book as a nonfiction and
sure.
Bring them into reality in the future if certain things don't change?
Well, I think, for example, you know, a lot of the things that we've already seen, such as we mentioned before, the Tucson school board banning of Latino studies, we've had, you know, riots in MacArthur Park in Los Angeles. We've had an increasing, I think Latinos have become the number one victims of hate crimes in the country over the last decade. We've had an escalation of, the vigilantes on the border, the increase of the border itself, you know, the militarization of the border, the growth of these extremist groups like the Hutari militia. All of these things are unfortunate pathways to a very potential of these books being prophetic, which is the last thing in the world that I would want. But oddly enough, I've actually had people from the far right who believe that they are actually, you know, manifestos and a call to action, which is, you know, it's crazy. I mean, they're irony impaired, but there clearly are people out there who would want to see this happen. And so that's my fear, is that we cannot let these kinds of people control the dialogue. I think the dedication of House Divided, the second book in the series, is to those who know that extremism is the only real enemy. And I lived through a revolution, you know, in Cuba, and saw the consequences of what happens. And I can tell you that it's not something we want to have, that kind of turmoil, but that it is scary how volatile things can be and how volatile they can get.
Well, now there is even discussion of states seceding from the nation.
Mm-hmm.
And at first when I heard it, I thought they were joking, but I'm starting to hear more that people are actually that serious about this concept.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I can see where we're looking at a whole new world if we're not open to seeing the issues that are facing today. So I can see how timely and how fantastic your books are, that it stimulates us to think, and I hope you continue your writing and you continue to be successful in alerting all of us in this potential ethnic conflict. And yes, there are new tools for warfare, and everyone should read this book at any age, at all times, and I'm also one of those persons that want to continue reading your works. Can you give us information, Raul, where we can find more information about your books, contact you, et cetera, from our listeners?
Sure, sure. Well, the easiest way is to go to my website, which is www.raulramos.com, RAULRAMOS, and then Sam.com. And that has all of the listings of where you can find me, and I am very active on Facebook, Twitter, Goodreads. In fact, I would also recommend the Class H Trilogy on Facebook. It's a Facebook page. It's also kind of fun. Every month, everybody who likes the page is automatically entered in a drawing to win a signed novel from the Class H Trilogy. So I would encourage listeners to go and like that page as well. And then also get in touch with me. My author site does have contact, and I love hearing from you. Friend me on Facebook. I am at Raul Ramos-Sanchez on Facebook, and would love to make your acquaintance.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to Raul Ramos-Sanchez. His final book on the trilogy, Pancholin. Please look him up, and I understand also your book. Is your book available on publication, or is it strictly still on paper?
The last book for the time being is only on Kindle. We have a other ebook publications and a print edition coming out in 2013. All the other books are both Kindle and print, or ebook and print.
I still like paper. I still prefer paper. I like to sit down and hold it in my hand. So
yeah.
So I'm still a paper person. There's something special about touching paper. I don't know.
There's
something about that. I won't push that. Ladies and gentlemen, please feel free to contact him. And one more time, Raul, could you give out your contact information, please?
I'm sorry, the last part again, Armando?
Could you please give out your contact information once again?
Oh, sure. www.raulramos.com, RaulRamos.com, and also on Facebook at Raul Ramos hyphen Sanchez, and then the Class H Trilogy on Facebook.
Ladies and gentlemen, we want to again thank Raul Ramos for being on the program. Latino Role Models and Success definitely shares with us that success is not always in material format. It's also getting the word out and being able to make us all think and appreciate what we have, but to understand that we cannot take things for granted. We do have to be proactive and protect what we have. We have to see through the eyes of our authors that gives us the idea of the realism of what we live in today, what may be potential in the future, good and bad. So once again, thank you for being here on the program. I'm Armando S. Sanchez, executive producer and host. You can find me on Facebook on Armando F. Sanchez, and we're not related to Raul, but I wish we were. Or you can email me at lsacnational@hotmail.com, lsacnational@hotmail.com. And if you need any information about Raul, please go directly to his website or contact me, and I'll try to pass on that information to him. But Raul, once again, thank you for being on the show. Keep us on the forefront of what could happen in the future and what we can do to prevent, and I welcome you back on the show anytime, at all times. I want to thank you again for being on the show. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen,
it's been a pleasure.
It's been our pleasure as well. Believe me, it's a real honor. So, ladies and gentlemen, once again, thank you for joining us at Latino Role Models and Success, and we look forward to having you on our next program. Thank you.